guess as you can gather by the handout, the topic has to do with the days of Noah. And that's a very interesting subject as far as I'm concerned. I'm anxious to hear Brother Leslie's discourse. So we'll introduce him at this time, Brother Leslie.
Dear brethren, we would like to bring you the love and greetings to the friends in Portland. Also would like to bring you the love and greetings of our son Aaron, who is now living in Ohio. He wanted to be remembered to you. And of course you have our love, Sharon, and my own greetings. We're very glad to be with you at this convention. I would like to mention something about the handouts. There's three pages, and actually you don't know what maybe is the first and the last page. This is the first page. That's the side that I want to call your attention to. Actually, it's the only sheet that may be of particular interest. I would like to say that this chart was prepared by Brother John Trezina, who is now passed to his reward, not only a fine and very good Bible student, but for me a very fine and good friend and companion for many years, and will always cherish his memory and friendship. The second page after this one was merely for those of you that like to look at numbers, and it may be of some interest of some relationship to the topic. The third page are for those of you that like pictures, and it also has very little relationship to the topic, but it may be of some subsequent interest. Of all the patriarchs, there is none so noble and yet obscure as the patriarch Noah. He was the 10th in the genealogy from Adam, yet he could not have met Adam. Adam died 126 years before his birth, and Adam's son Seth died just 14 years before his birth. Noah's father Lamech could have easily conversed with both. He had an important heritage to pass to his son Noah, who now lay beyond all direct acquaintance with Eden. Other than his work concerning the deluge, we know very little other than other events in Noah's life. We know his first child was born when he was 500 years old. There was probably, this was probably Japheth. But we do not know the name of his wife, nor the names of his sons' wives. We can deduce that his father Lamech died just 5 years before the flood, and that Methuselah died in the very year of the flood. Our curious mind might ask, if the flood was arranged to occur only after all the righteous ancestors of Noah had died, or were there preparations to take them aboard the ark also if they had lived just a bit longer? But outside the flood, what else do we know of this Noah? Well, given the human situation, there are a number of things that we can infer. Let us turn first to Genesis 6, verse 8 and 9. Genesis 6, 8. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations, and Noah walked with God. In these simple phrases, there is a profound character revealed. The earlier verses reveal a situation where angels materialized to cohabit with beautiful women of earth. Their offspring were a distortion of the genetic structure in such a way that all the children appear to have been male. Verse 4. and were called Nephilim. These giants imposed their reign of tyranny on mankind until there were nearly none left who were not subjected to them. That their fathers were angels is derived from the phrase sons of God. This is an idiomatic expression. Where this phrase is found, like in Job 2, verse 1, and also in Job 38, verse 7, Psalms 29, 1, Psalms 89, 6 and 7, and also in Daniel 3, 25, it always refers to spirit beings. This invasion into human procreation was a distortion of the human program and was promoted by Satan to thwart the work of the promised seed of the woman and to impose his own dominion. This was the second of several attempts to destroy the seed. The first was when Cain was incited to kill his brother. The seed of Abraham was later disputed by Hagar and Ishmael. Pharaoh sought to kill all the firstborn males and nearly entrapped Moses, and later tried to prevent the Israelites from departing to the promised land. Herod sought the child's life and destroy the seed. Jesus in the wilderness was tempted to take his own life. Perhaps Satan thought for a moment he had succeeded at the cross. But the natural seed continued, and then a spiritual seed appeared. Saints were killed, but not destroyed. The Holocaust took many of the natural seed, but the promise is sure. This early apostasy by Satan and the fallen angels created a bleak prospect for Noah in planning for another generation. He had no polluted breeding in his own ancestry. We do not know when he took a wife, but we can be sure he carefully investigated her genealogy before binding his life with hers. She may have also been of the lineage of Enoch or Methuselah. In fact, he may have only married after several hundred years. They did not have children until he was 500 years old. They may not have been married very long before that, and she may have been considerably younger than he. Their sons, though taking wives of pure lineage, delayed having children till after the flood, when they were above 100 years old. So these years before the flood were occupied with keeping themselves separate from the world. Yet they were a spectacle to men and angels while building the ark. Their labors and clarity of vision were not appreciated by an evil generation. Theirs was a mission to deliver the race into a new world. There is a text that has some obscure meaning in Genesis 6, verse 3. The Lord said, "My spirit shall not always strive with man, for that he also is flesh. Yet his day shall be 120 years." There has been much written on the text, and various readings have been produced. Brother Russell has very little to say on it. The word strive has variously been rendered rule, abide, struggle, remain, tarry, and so forth. And the phrase that he also is flesh has been rendered become flesh, is mortal, become carnal, and such phrases. And so various questions are raised. First, when were these words first decreed? Was it at the outbreak of the apostasy? Was it 120 years before the flood? When iniquity had reached a point of no return? We're not exactly told. Secondly, who first heard these words? Was it Noah or his righteous ancestors? Thirdly, upon whom is the 120 years decreed? Adam? The Nephilim? Noah? Or the generations after the flood? And fourthly, what was the decree? What was its purpose? The years that might be left to Adam at the time of speaking? The years left to the Nephilim before the flood? The years of Noah at the time of hearing before the flood? Or the diminished lifespan to mankind in the generations after the flood? Among all these theories, we are persuaded of a fairly simple application, that the words were decreed 120 years before the flood, that Noah was the audience, that they referred to the probation period on the Nephilim before the flood that took them all away. Perhaps the meaning is simply, these spirits will not always struggle with mankind. Since they have chosen to become flesh, they will be cut off after 120 years. That's what I think the meaning is. This rises out of the meaning of 1 Peter 3, verse 20. Here, Peter speaks of the disobedience of the angels while God waited during the preparation of the ark. The ark may have been in preparation for all or some part of those 120 years. However, Noah's children were born only 100 years before the flood. It is possible Noah heard this warning 120 years before the flood and began his own family planning in preparations for that event. By the year of the flood, his sons were married but had no children. Except for this small family of 8 souls, all others of their ancestors had died. All others were contaminated with the evil seed. We can only imagine Noah's courage of faith in preaching the judgments declared in these years. His persistence in the face of scoffers and his deep commitment to the creatures to be transported into the new dispensation. Hebrews 11, verse 7. By faith Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, moved with fear, prepared an ark to the saving of his house, by the which he condemned the world, and became heir of the righteousness which is by faith. The dimensions of the ark are given as 300 by 50 by 30 cubits. We think this was ample room to store all the species native to that area, today known as Iran, Iraq, and Turkey. The only features mentioned are that it had 3 stories, a door, and a window. It had neither masts, rudder, nor sails. This was not a ship that could be navigated by its passengers. It was a floating barge for containing animals and food for a year. God controlled its destiny. Someday mankind may have a better look at this craft of deliverance when the snows yield its secret treasures. The creatures were to be gathered by 7s for clean animals and by 2s for unclean. The reason for 7s may have been because of their use for food and for sacrifice, while the unclean only had to fill their roles in the ecological balance. The 7s may have been paired by 3s, plus 1 male each. The animals probably came uncoerced to Noah's shelter, because often the beasts of earth are wiser than man. They know where there is food and shelter from storm. In Genesis 6, verse 18, God promises to make a covenant with this small family about to face the storm. Later in Genesis 9, verse 12, he does make a covenant with them and with all the creatures with them. So, with this hope in hand, all the remnant proceeded towards the shelter against the tempest. And now a curiously detailed sequence of events is recorded, and it may help to follow along in this chart, to track the events of this year. It seems so detailed explanations are given, and yet very little on either side of this one year in Noah's life. First, there seems to be 7 days of waiting, when all the work was complete. Yet before the family entered, the record is found in Genesis 6, verses 4, 10, and 13. These 7 days are mentioned. Then after entering, the Lord shut the door. Genesis 6, verse 16. On the second month, the 17th day of the year, the flood waters broke forth, and the downpour continued for 40 days, verses 11 and 12 and 17. Even after the rain ceased, the free-floating of the ark in the tidal waters continued another 110 days, or a total of 150 since entering the ark. Genesis 6, verse 24, and chapter 7, verse 3. Then on the seventh month, the 17th day, or just 5 months after the outbreak, the ark came to rest on some ridge of Ararat, and the waters continued to recede. Genesis 8, verse 4. Then continuing on the tenth month, the first day, the family could see other mountains due to the clearing of the atmosphere and the receding waters. Genesis 8, verse 5. After another 40 days, Noah opened a window and sent forth a raven. But as a carrion creature, it went to and fro on the waters, feeding on the corpses. Then after a week, he sent forth a dove. Not being a meat eater, it returned to the ark, finding no place of rest. Another week passed. And he sent forth the dove again. It returned with an olive leaf plucked from a sprouting tree. So we found an olive leaf here this morning. So we'll just put that here for display. He returned with this olive leaf in its beak. Yet another week passed, and he sent the dove again. It did not return, apparently finding some dry place to build a nest for a new generation. The account is found in Genesis 8, verses 7 through 12. And now the second year begins. The second year, first month, first day. The face of the ground was dry. Verse 13. On the second month, the 27th day, or just 1 year and 10 days after entering the ark, the ground was sufficiently dry to emerge. Noah, his family, and all breathing creatures went forth and multiplied on the face of the earth. Verses 14 to 19. The first act of Noah is to build an altar, and from among the clean animals offered burnt offerings. A tradition prevails that he fueled the altar with wood from the door of the ark. His gesture was one of faith that it would not be needed ever again. Noah had already sacrificed his home, his society, his whole world. Now he made this offering in gratitude for deliverance. Would God be pleased for his conduct? The animals were the seed and food for a new society. This is the first mention of an altar and of burnt offerings. Would God accept this tribute representing the very essence of their livelihood? God received it as the sweetest of human gestures and vowed not to curse the ground or smite every living creature again. Chapter 8, 20 and 21. From this time there appears to emerge a distinction of seasons for growing and harvest on the earth. Verse 22. So, brethren, in all the events of this tumultuous year, we see nothing of the death struggle. We do not witness the frantic agony outside the ark. Nothing of the anxiety of man or beast inside for food or for light. Nor is there a single word of regret or lament for the world that was left behind. There is nothing to salvage from the old order except the seed of hope that was sown in Eden. Genesis 9 records the Noah covenant. Having come through the waters, God established an everlasting covenant with man and beast. There will never again be a flood to destroy all flesh. The rainbow is the token of this covenant. Whenever God brings a cloud over the earth, he will remember his covenant with every living creature. Now let us look at the New Testament and the brief references there to these events. I'll just give you the references first and then we'll talk about them. There's only a few. The first reference is Matthew 24, 37 to 39. And there's a parallel account in the Gospel of Luke, Luke 17, 26 and 27. Then there's Hebrews 11, 7, which we read concerning Noah. And then there's a few more references in Peter. In 1 Peter 3, 19 and 20. 2 Peter 2, 19 and 20. And the last one is 2 Peter 3, 4 through 7. And this is basically a reference back to Isaiah 54, 9 and 10. So, Matthew, Luke, Hebrews, and 1 and 2 Peter. The Matthew and Luke accounts are properly read with emphasis on the sign of ignorance of the impending events. Though the antediluvians were awfully wicked, it is not precisely their wickedness, but their worldliness, their unbelief, and indifference to the future that we are called upon to notice. Luke 17 makes the same point and adds that this disregard for the impending events continued until the day Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. It was a willing disregard, for they did not heed the message of Noah, who is called a preacher of righteousness in 2 Peter 2, verse 5. A preacher of righteousness. The parallelism with our day is obvious. Noah's family is a picture of the church in the flesh before their deliverance. Notice the similar message of Elijah in Malachi 4, 5 and 6, to turn the heart of the fathers, lest they come and smite the earth with a curse. The day of the Lord has now been observed and proclaimed for 118 years. It has been 114 years since the spiritual heavens were cast off. Today the world is in a more sorry state than it was then. The financial systems of the world are bankrupt. while the nations of Europe plan for a grandiose financial unity with hopes to heal the fractured nations of the world. High society eats sumptuously while Somalia starves and children dehydrate in the arms of their mothers. America practices a political charade while blood runs in the streets of Yugoslavia. Babylon says, I am rich and increased with goods and have need of nothing. I sit as a queen and am no widow and shall see no sorrow. Yet she is poor, blind, and naked. This is certainly ignorance of the impending desolation of the present social order. Yet this only whets our appetite to look further for additional correspondences to the days of Noah. Matthew 24, verse 30 to 35, mentions other key elements of Noah's day. These verses mention the clouds of heaven, all the tribes of the earth mourning, the gathering of the elect, this generation, heaven and earth pass away. All these phrases are drawn directly from Noah's day. I think the phrases eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage have special meaning. They are identical in Matthew and Luke. They are acts of self-preservation and pleasure. To eat is to preserve self first. It does not say to serve or to feed others. Drinking may imply a state of intoxication, illusion, and self-indulgence. In ancient times, marriage was a form of alliance, and in some cases, even compromise. Families might give a daughter, even to a foreign tribe, in return for assurances of non-aggression. So it is today. There is no global view of human need among the nations. Nations, states, cities, corporations, and people consume and feed their own interests first. To feed their own securities with little regard how others may suffer. It's not a lack of food that keeps Somalia starving. They are starving for political selfishness and greed. The nations are drunk with their own illusions of glory and ambitions for a new world order at their own hands. Alliances are formed with hope for aid in time of trouble, but which evaporates when nations cannot even help themselves. Daughter institutions are given over to world evangelism and ecumenical unions to promote a vision of world unity, to give an illusion of world unity. While acknowledging the point of ignorance that Jesus makes, it cannot be forgotten that the days of Noah were wicked and were dominated by fallen angels and their giant offspring. Jude verse 6 seems to describe the state of the fallen angels of Noah's day. They were bound in darkness until the judgment of the great day. This implies a test in the last day, in which they might again assert their apostasy. In Noah's day, their children were giants of oppression and violence. These were destroyed and were not delivered, nor did they survive the flood. In our day, the giants are global mega institutions of finance, government, corporate, and military might. They are cruel, inhuman, and oppressive in nature. They are spawned by evil spirits with ambitions of world domination. Jude extends this analogy in the picture of Sodom and Gomorrah in verse 7. He says the cities were given over to fornication, going after strange flesh. This strange flesh was the angelic materialization assumed in the night of Lot's deliverance, recorded in Genesis 19. In our day, the unions with these angelic forms of New Age ideology and philosophy are condoned, are condemned by Earth's new administrator. They are condemned. It is interesting that in the Luke 17 account, Jesus follows the example of Noah with that of Lot and Sodom in verses 28 and 29. So, after the deliverance of the church, may see society abandoned to the very depths of depravity. While Noah and his family were generally taken, are generally taken to correspond to the faithful and righteous church in the last days, Lot is taken as a picture of the great company who find accommodation in worldly surroundings. So this picture of being pulled away from the fire follows the example of the deliverance of Noah. The great company are pictured in Jeremiah 8 as a class who enter into defense cities and later acknowledge the harvest is past, the summer is ended, and they are not saved. 2 Peter 2, 4 through 7 expands on the sequence. 2 Peter 2, 4 through 7. If God spared not the angels that sinned, but cast them down to hell, and delivered them into chains of darkness, to be reserved unto judgment, and spared not the old world, but saved Noah, the eighth person, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood upon the world of the ungodly, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them with an overthrow, making them an ensample unto those that after should live ungodly, and delivered just Lot, vexed with the filthy conversation of the wicked. So, brethren, let our lives be like Noah and Abraham, who not only delivered themselves, but became instruments of deliverance for others. The Sodom picture is the final stage of the time of trouble. The Noah picture, when the church has the door closed behind them. The Luke account of Jesus' words, Luke 17, 29, used the word apocalypsis, not parousia, for the revealing of the Son of Man in this final trauma. Then, of course, there is the picture of Lot's wife. In Luke 17:32, Jesus concludes the metaphor by telling us to remember Lot's wife. She being turned to salt is a picture of second death, final destruction. Let us not cling to earthly institutions and their elusive promises. Let it be that our faithfulness be established before the Sodom picture comes upon this generation. The days of Noah were days of preaching. Hebrews 11:7 says Noah was warned. 2 Peter 2:5 says that he preached. 2 Peter 3:3 through 6 tells us that his message was scorned. Do we expect our message to be broadly received? Or will we be silent in declaring the overthrow of this old order and the new dispensation blessings that lie just beyond the flood of trouble? But Noah was not only preaching. He was working and building. In some sense, the ark represents Christ's covenant of sacrifice. When all have faithfully entered and kept the terms of this commitment, they will become the power and instruments to replenish and reorganize society. 1 Peter 3:21 likens the ark to the deliverance of baptism. This is not the literal baptism of water that marks the beginning of our journey, but the completion of our baptism. As Jesus said in Luke 12:50, I have a baptism to be baptized with, and how am I straitened till it be accomplished? 1 Peter 3:20. Here God is described as being long-suffering or patient while the ark was preparing. This was not patience with that wicked generation. Their judgment was already sealed in the sentence of Genesis 6:3-7. God's patience was with the completing of the ark. He will not remove the old order before his people have secured the means of their deliverance. A similar picture is given us in Revelation 7:2-3, in the sealing in the forehead, before the winds are loosed. How long the ark was in preparation, we are not told exactly, or when Noah received his commission, or when the 120 years began. It is possible that Noah began the work with a few of the faithful generation that preceded him, but were still living, who, however, died before the flood. The work may have continued with Noah's sons and daughters-in-law when they matured enough to work. Today, it is not so different. God is not being patient with this evil generation, which is destined to pass away. He is patient with us. In our preparation work, the old order will not pass away until the agents of the new world order are prepared. The year of transition, while secured in the ark, has so little recorded details. Yet so much is implied. All witnessing had ceased, obviously. It was a dark night when no man could work. No outside screams of panic are recorded. The feeding and cleaning duties are not detailed. The only devotions, the daily devotions, are not mentioned. The source of internal light is not mentioned, nor how they were able to count days and months. We are developing a faith that will be in repose when no earthly cords bind us to this earth, that will not anguish over the departing institutions, that rests fully in God to meet our every need. It will be remembered in Genesis 7:16 that God closed the door behind the Noah class. When Noah emerged beyond the storm, his first act was to offer a burnt offering. He took from the clean beast and offered a multitude of burnt offerings. This in itself was an act of faith. First, he was anticipating the principles later laid down in the Mosaic Law for clean and unclean. Second, he was sacrificing from the very animals that were to become the seed stock for herds and food for the new generation. He offered from those things God preserved and offered them to the Almighty himself. Tradition, as we said, records that Noah used the door of the ark as firewood for the altar. This, too, would have been an act of faith that the arrangement of the ark would never again be needed. When our sacrifices are finished, there will be no more need of this ark. A burnt offering is generally understood as the acceptance of a prior sacrifice. Upon the deliverance of the church, God accepts the lives of the spiritual seed as a sweet fragrance. He will confirm the accepted work of the Christ body complete. It will give the signal for the earthly portion of the Abrahamic seed to go forth and begin a new and restored family of earth. After the acceptance of Noah's burnt offering, Genesis 9 details the rainbow covenant between God and all flesh. In verses 12 and 16, it is described as perpetual and everlasting. In Jeremiah 31, the new covenant is set in contrast to the purging process of these days. Jeremiah 31:28, as I have watched over them to pluck up and to break down and to throw down and to destroy and to afflict, so I will watch over them to build and to plant, saith the Lord. Is it not so when the church's sacrifice is complete, the Christ body is complete, and they are all delivered, then God will make a new covenant with the earthly seed. It will be a confirmation of the rainbow covenant in that he promised not to destroy all flesh again. While in these days of impending gloom, man fears the destruction of all flesh, Jesus assures us in Matthew 24:22 that the days of threatening all flesh will be shortened by the elect. Not only will the threat be stayed, but all flesh will be saved in respect to the rainbow covenant. And these will be under the terms of the new covenant and under the new heavens and the new earth recorded in Revelation 21:1-5. The point that Jesus makes about the days of Noah are not that he comes at the point of extremity to rescue mankind, but that as in the days preceding the flood, as in the days of Noah, he would already be present and unknown to society, arranging for human deliverance. These are not signs of his coming, but of his presence. Parousia is used four times in Matthew 24, in verse 37, 27, 37, and 39. I want to conclude this lesson with an allegory of four birds. The raven, as an unclean blackbird that feeds on dead flesh, may picture the first dispensation under the dominion of fallen angels. They sought their home amongst the carcasses of a dying generation. There was nothing for them to return to the ark. The dove pictures God's Holy Spirit with different administrations in three dispensations. First, God's Spirit worked through the law and the prophets in the Jewish age. But though Israel returned to the bonds of their covenant, it was empty-handed. Israel hath not obtained that which he seeketh for. The second dove was sent out in the gospel age with the mission to prepare a people for his name. This age will bring into the covenant the seal of peace and hope with a completed church. The third dove of God's Spirit will be sent out upon the new earth in God's kingdom, and there it will find its eternal home and restored and to a restored mankind. So, brethren, what shall we say of our day of clouds? Well, we would say with 2 Peter 3, verse 10 to 14, the day of the Lord will come as a thief, in which the heavens shall pass away with great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. The earth also, and the works that are therein, shall be burned up. Seeing now that all these things shall be dissolved, what manner of persons ought ye to be in all holy conversation and godliness, looking for and hastening the presence of the day of God, wherein the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for a new heavens and a new earth, wherein dwelleth righteousness. Wherefore, beloved, seeing that ye look for such things, be diligent that ye may be found in him, in peace, without spot, and blameless. And finally, we would say with Paul in 1 Thessalonians 3, 12 to 13, the Lord make you to increase and abound in love one toward another, and toward all, even as we do toward you, to the end that he may establish your hearts unblameable in holiness before God, even our Father, at the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ with all his saints. Brethren, it is up to you to bring home the olive leaf.
Thank you, Brother Leslie. Certainly appreciate that discourse, and I find it very, very interesting. Lessons from the days of Noah. We might mention at this time that, and Brother Leslie will close with prayer.
Our Father in heaven, hallowed be thy most holy name. We thank thee for the examples, the precedents, and the pictures made out for us in thy word. We pray that thy kingdom soon come and thy will be done on earth even as it is done in heaven. We desire to be instruments and agents of thy peace. We long for the time that mankind will see and know thee, the God of truth and a God of love. Help us to practice the principles of truth and righteousness in these days that remain to us, and to be faithful examples of thy loving care. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.